Welcome to the Buffalo's Fire podcast, brought to you by the Indigenous Media Freedom Alliance. I'm your host, Alicia Haglin Thorpe. Buffalo's Fire is an Indigenous-led independent news organization that reflects the voice of our Indigenous community. We are a 501c3 nonprofit media organization. One of our goals is to strengthen tribal sovereignty through an informed citizenry. You can stay informed by signing up for Buffalo's Fire newsletter. Be the first to find out the latest news in Indian Country at buffaloesfire.com, or you can sign up for our text message alerts. Text BizNews to 877-876-0111 to stay informed and stay connected. You can also find us on Facebook at Buffalo's Fire. Like our page and share our stories. On our show today is the Executive Director of the International Indigenous Treaty Council, Andrea Carmen. I interviewed her at the end of February 2024 when she was visiting the Standing Rock Tribal Council, laying the groundwork for the upcoming 50th Anniversary Treaty Conference of the International Indigenous Treaty Council, or IITC, planned for the 21st through the 24th of June 2024 in Wakpala, South Dakota. I found out during the interview that she has an incredible amount of experience and passion for this work. She's been the executive director for over 30 years, but has roots going even further back as an intern. In this podcast, Ms. Carmen tells us how and why the IITC started, and eventually how it became the first Indigenous Peoples organization to receive general consultative status from the UN. She also talks about what impacts the council is making on climate change, food sovereignty, and repatriation. Here's a hint. She says people are finally listening. Here's the IITC's executive director, Andrea Carmen.
I am from the Yaqui Indigenous Nation, which is divided between the border of United States and Mexico now. They ran a border through the middle of our country a couple hundred years ago, and it's a pretty seriously maintained border these days. But we have six pueblos or Yaqui communities in Arizona, southern Arizona, including a reservation, federally recognized tribal government, and then we have a large land base in northern Mexico, in Sonora, Mexico. We have the only treaty with any indigenous nation and the government of Mexico because we were at war with them till 1939. And so we got a treaty in recognition of our part of our traditional land base, and we have eight unbroken traditional governments there that still operate by a traditional government consensus system. Anything to do with the land and the land base there and the water rights has to be agreed to by consensus of all eight of the traditional governments, and they come to consensus within themselves. On the Mexico side, by law, all of our government meetings have to be conducted in our language 100%. So it's an unbroken traditional government system. And it's still the primary language of fluency in our lands on the Mexico side. Now we have to say side, right? Sure. And on the Arizona side, just like here, you know, kids have gone to school and, you know, all of that. And so there's a struggle to hold the language fluency on the Arizona side. Okay. But in Mexico, most of the households and all of the people, I'd say 50 years and above, that's their primary language, is Yaqui, our indigenous language.
How did you get the position here with IITC? Like, what kind of brought you in? What kind of led you up to this?
Well, it's been a long time. I started working with IITC as a student intern when I was going to school at University of California in Santa Cruz. We formed an organization within the Women's Studies Department where we had probably five or six indigenous women to respond to the policy of the United States government of forced sterilization of Native American women, you know, in places like Claremore, Oklahoma, Rocky Boy, Montana, Rosebud, you know, all over the place. So we formed Coalition Against Sterilization Abuse, CASA. through the Women's Studies Department that we were able to get course credit for the organizing. And I met Lehman Brightman was our faculty advisor. He's from Rosebud. And he introduced me to Bill Wapipaw, who was coordinating the work of the IITC in San Francisco. And this was back in 1976 or so.
Okay.
And I became a student intern for IITC. I traveled around for a while after I graduated, and then I got convinced to come back and see about working with the IITC, and they started sending me to, you know, some of the international meetings along with the elders and the more experienced people. And finally, I became a staff person, full-time staff person in 1983. I became executive director in 1992, so it's been 31 years. Kind of amazing to even think that. So I'm still very involved in the program work. I'm the lead person for IITC with a really good, strong team at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. I'm going from here to Rome to a meeting at UN Food and Agriculture Organization. IITC does a lot of work in the area of food sovereignty, everything from supporting the work of grassroots food producers on the ground, you know, to bringing them together to share knowledge and information, to impacting international policy, to support, you know, the perspectives of our traditional food producers, because frankly, that's what's going to save our lives with the climate crisis that's happening. I go to these meetings and hear the scientists and the governments, and, you know, last year was the single largest domestic oil production by the United States government in history. The year before that was the largest was under Trump, 2019. So all this talk about, you know, climate change and, you know, alternative energy, and, you know, we met with John Kerry, I have several times before, and they're trying to change the conversation from fossil fuel production to emissions reduction, which means this scary new technology they're coming up with called carbon capture and carbon injection and all these things that are not going to work, and they're going to cause more destruction. Not only that, they're going to move indigenous peoples off of their traditional lands, things like, you know, forest offsets and, you know, all these things that, you know, they talk about net zero. Well, what does net mean? It means, you know, you can still have the, you know, the oil fields on Fort Berthold or the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, if you're investing in saving some forests in the Amazon where indigenous peoples are pushed off their land because now it's a carbon capture sink, you know. I mean, this is what we're seeing, the solutions that are being proposed. We've made a breakthrough, we just did in Dubai at the last climate change talks, COP28. Of the UN, of really helping the countries to understand the indigenous people's knowledge about food production, whether it's restoring buffalo and, you know, getting rid of cattle, whether it's bringing back our traditional drought-resistant seeds, pesticide-free methods, is part of solution to climate change. Because healthy living soil is the third largest absorber of greenhouse gases. The first is the ocean, which they're contaminating fast. Yeah. Second is the atmosphere, hence, you know, climate change. Mm-hmm. And the third is healthy living soil that's not killed by pesticides or chemicals or overgrazing and all those things. So we have that knowledge that we can bring into the talks. And the countries are really starting to realize that indigenous knowledge holders that we've brought officially into those discussions for just the last 3 years have solutions to offer. We're not just complaining about the impacts and about the land loss and, you know, the things that are happening as a result, but we have something to contribute, and we're actually starting to see that make an impact. They really are listening. And so we think, gee, they must be really scared. They're listening to us.
It's hopeful, though.
Yeah.
It's hopeful.
It's hopeful. It's hopeful. But my best advice to everybody, indigenous peoples, find out your own source of food and find out your own source of water. People don't know how bad it's going to get. I have to hear the scientists talk about what is coming and what's already here. Last year, for the first time, the global temperature broke through what was supposed to be the cap, right, in the Paris Agreement, the 1.5 degrees centigrade increase. In July and August, it exceeded it last year for the first time. And it was the hottest year ever recorded in the Sonora Desert, where I live. You know, so, I mean, it was, we had over 100 degrees for 60 days straight. Mm. So we're trying to work with seeds that can survive that. Right. We have a family farm, you could say, you know, and doing seed trading with other indigenous peoples in the desert. You know, our original seeds, not the ones that have been modified and reduced in vitality, because, you know, and everybody really has to do that. I see, you know, buffalo here, and buffalo are a key part of resilience against climate change for the people here. Go back to your original food that understands how to live there and can withstand the variances of climate that are just getting worse. So another one, we're creating a international mechanism for repatriation of indigenous people's cultural items and human remains that are in museums and private collections and auction houses and universities all over the planet. People don't even know where their items are. Last July, we got returned our sacred masakova, which is a, masakova is literal in our language for deer's head. It's a ceremonial deer's head for our deer dance. But for us, once it's been in a ceremony, it's alive. It's not like a thing, it's a living being. We say Sayula Maso, our little brother of the deer. I saw it, you know, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. I came upon it in a museum in Stockholm, Sweden, of all places. The Samis invited me to this event, and it's a government museum, too. It's like the Smithsonian. And it took us 20 years to get it back. And then we engaged the United Nations, because the museum in Sweden wasn't giving it back. They said that. We don't see why we should give it back. We have it. You guys have no, you know, no claim that's legal. And we forced them through the United Nations intervention to return it. I mean, the UN declaration that they've agreed to says they're supposed to return it. So with that struggle, we really saw the need to activate, because so many, you know, indigenous peoples say the same thing. We, our ghost shirt, they took our ghost shirt. We don't know where it is. They took our treaty pipe, they told me, in Canada. We don't know where it is. The Chickasaws are trying to get the skull of one of their chiefs back, who was taken as a war trophy, and they've been trying to do it for more than 30 years, and they can't. So we're creating an international mechanism. Have to work with UNESCO, the UN Education Scientists and Cultural Organization, which is hard to work with for a few reasons, but creating a mechanism and a protocol that indigenous peoples will, number one, first be able to find their items, like an international database, and then regulations that will mandate that if indigenous people say this item is sacred, and all human remains need to come back to the rightful caretakers of those items to be able to see how they should be put to rest, or, you know, where they should be, who should take care of them.
You're listening to the Buffalo's Fire podcast with special guest Andrea Carmen, the longtime executive director of the International Indigenous Treaty Council. She's responsible for bringing indigenous voices to the table with those who make the decisions on the environment, climate change, food sovereignty, and the repatriation of our relatives. In this next half, she says something pretty startling, that in all her years working with indigenous people, she has never found an indigenous language that has a literal translation for human rights. She also talks about what happens at Treaty Council meetings, like the 50th Anniversary Council meeting planned in Standing Rock, where the first one was convened in 1974.
Well, it came out of a history of indigenous peoples' activism being revitalized and standing up the fishing rights struggles on the Pacific Coast. The treaty rights struggles, the walks across the country, the armed occupations at Wounded Knee, court cases, everything. Yeah. People tried everything to get the treaties to be honored and to get justice. The first meeting came out of basically all the lack of results. In fact, more repression, more people were in jail, people were killed. You know, Leonard Peltier's still in prison from those days. And the decision was made by the elders and the founders, who these elders here today have talked about, Frank Fool's Crow, you know, Matthew King, those that came together at the first gathering to seek a voice and a seat in the international arena as nations, as treaty nations, because we weren't represented there and because we could not find justice within the so-called justice systems, not just of the United States, but there were people from Canada there, from Guatemala, from Brazil. There were 5,000 people from throughout the Americas telling the same exact story. How can we find justice in the colonial systems that are the ones that have oppressed us? So IITC was instructed, you know, to go to the United Nations, find a seat, find a voice. It's been since 1977. IITC was the first indigenous organization to get what's called consultative status at the United Nations Economic and Social Council. And in 2001, we were the only one still to be upgraded to what's called general consultative status because of how many bodies we're working at. We're still, you know, full force in the human rights arena. We're at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. We're at climate change. We're at the United Nations Environment Program, Convention on Biodiversity. Everywhere where our rights are being discussed and impacted, we feel we have not just a right, but a responsibility to try to be there. IITC accepts no government money from any government. So our struggle is all, you know, funding to get to these places. We write proposals, we sell t-shirts, you know, we do all those things.
Are you a 501c3? Or?
Yes, we're a nonprofit 501c3. Okay. But we're unique also since the very beginning in being a representative indigenous body. So we have 14 board members from the different geographical areas. Bill Means is still on the board from Ochete Sokoan. And at the treaty conferences, like the one we're about to have, not only are we commemorating 50 years of survival, I guess you could say, and a lot of historic achievements. We were one of the leaders in the struggle to get the United Nations Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples adopted, you know, in 2007. It took 30 years. The first UN meeting that IITC led the way on was 1977. And that meeting in Geneva called for an international standard recognizing the collective rights of indigenous peoples. So when the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples was adopted 30 years later, exactly 2007 at the General Assembly, that represented the achievement of that objective, I guess you could say, from our first meeting ever at the UN. So we tend to take the instructions from our peoples, our affiliates, and you'll see it if you come to Standing Rock. They'll do resolutions, they'll be adopted by consensus of everybody, and those are our instructions for what to work on, what positions to take. What do we want to do about, you know, biodiversity or intellectual property where they're patenting our traditional seeds?
So at these conferences, then, it's a place for discussion and how to make change.
Exactly. Yeah. And what our affiliates want IITC to do. We've made some real progress in kind of bringing treaties back into the international limelight. In the last couple years, we have at least two internationally legally binding treaty bodies to which the United States is a party. They're supposed to implement them, calling on the United States to set up a nation-to-nation process with the treaty partners where there's an equal participatory participation to talk about treaty violations, not like the courts, where that's the decision-making of one of the treaty partners, usually the violating partner. You know, how can they be the ones who decide if there's a violation, let alone what should be the remedy? We've actually brought that discussion back up again in the United Nations bodies that are telling the United States, you need to do this. And so now the question is, okay, how are we going to do this? It's not just for IITC, it's for the treaty nations that are part of IITC. I don't think some indigenous peoples realize how many indigenous nations are treaty nations. The nation of Hawaii, which will be at the conference, they're on our board of directors, made before the U.S. forcibly invaded them and annexed them in violation of their peace and friendship treaty with Hawaii, nation of Hawaii, they made treaties with 18 countries. And not one of those countries said anything when the U.S., you know, decided to annex Hawaii instead of respect it as a separate country, a nation. So the treaty movement needs to be revitalized. We need to make sure that all of the treaty nations know each other, even know about each other, and really create an international movement to bring back the treaty discussion onto the table, on the front burner, front and center. You know, three of the four countries that voted against the UN Declaration when it was adopted at the General Assembly were the three countries that have some of the most treaties with indigenous peoples, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand. The other one was Australia, that where the Aborigines really would like to have a treaty. They don't have any treaty, you know, but they should, and they want one.
Okay, let's rein it in.
Okay.
All right, so the purpose of being in Standing Rock today, if you can explain a little more about it.
We came here to meet with the Tribal Council and also the Elders Preservation Council, who've been having kind of independent discussions about hosting the 50th anniversary. Really, there was no place we could have the 50th anniversary treaty conference except Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. So we're super excited. We're being met with open arms and a lot of enthusiasm and interest because it's part of Standing Rock's history, not just ours, of course. And a lot of people are really interested in revitalizing those discussions, you know, talking about, you know, what is treaty? And what does that mean? So our first goal is to bring everybody in and have the affiliates, the members of the nation, whoever's hosting it, be able to hear themselves what is happening, you know, with the work that we've been doing, you know, for however many years in the past. Because they're not, you know, maybe two or three people can go to, you know, a conference in another country, but we want to have the whole people understand and hear and have a chance to be updated and learn from what's happening. And I try to explain that a lot of the issues we're dealing with directly are the decisions are made in some international arena. And if we're not at the table, as they say, you know, we're on the menu. And also, like I said, about the climate change, we have something to offer. We're not just there to be on the defense, even though we've got to do that, no doubt about it. We get those instructions, you know, we adopt resolutions. There's commissions that will happen. There's panels, you know, plenary discussion for everybody. But then people will break into kind of working groups we call commissions. And from all the different indigenous peoples that are there, you know, people want to talk about mining, whether they're from Guatemala or the Black Hills or, you know, other places. That's affecting them. So they come up with a resolution. They present it on the last day. A lot of people are interested in more than one topic, but they got to choose. That's their time to say, well, can you include our sacred site struggle in that resolution? Mm-hmm. And everyone accepts it, but the affiliates agree that this is adopted by consensus. This becomes IITC policy, and this is what we're going to do. And usually we have them once every 2 years just because kind of expensive.
And so I heard you talk earlier about how important it is to follow protocol. Can you explain a little more about why protocol is important to follow on something like this?
That's part of our guiding principles. We support and uphold the spiritual cultural practices of each of our affiliates, and they're different, and how you are in a certain place is going to be different. So we never want to undermine the traditional cultural practices. Most, if not all, of our staff and definitely board members and affiliates are very involved in the ceremonial way of life of their own peoples. We just started last week our 7-week spring cycle that will end with the deer dance. You know, in about 7 weeks. That's one of the things we support strongly, is the right to practice our culture, the protection of our sacred sites, our ways of life, our language. Another very exciting thing that I just want to mention is the growing role and leadership of Indigenous youth in the international work, and we're really going to feature that. We have some very strong youth representatives that are staff members who will be here and want to meet with the youth groups from here and other places that have said they're really excited. Climate change, of course, is an issue. Our young people are very involved, and we will have a panel of Indigenous youth and definitely a commission of youth where they can say, okay, this is, as youth, this is where we want IITC to go, because they're the future of the organization. I mean, the sustainability of our work depends on bringing in Indigenous youth that have that same vision of the original founding of IITC. You can look on our webpage for the Declaration of Continuing Independence, the founding document that was adopted here in 1974, that have that vision. At the same time, they have new strategies, they have new ideas, and we have to be open to that. Sometimes it's hard.
But I think that is so important, that even though we are a culture of passing on oral knowledge and traditions, I think it's important to embrace the fact that there is technology that can help preserve these too. And, you know, when we say going back to our traditional ways prior to colonization, you know, there was no digitalization then. Mm-hmm. But having to understand that that intersection of new technology and what our traditions are and why it's so important that they come together. Yeah. And our youth is going to be a prime example of what that means.
I was about, 18, and I said to my grandma, probably I was being a brat, right, saying, well, how can we keep our traditions going in this modern world? It's so different, you know, I don't even think that they fit. And she said, what you need to do is take the values in our traditional cultures and apply them to what's going on now.
Yeah.
And I had, of course, no comeback for that. Yeah, you know, I remember it really clearly. It was in the kitchen at my mom's house, you know. So finding youth that understand, yes, there's new technologies and they can communicate with each other. I think COVID gifted us Zoom, for example.
Oh, my gosh,
you know?
Right?
Yes, yeah. But we still use it because we can talk to each other. You mm-hmm. can actually see each other, not like a conference call.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't replace that face-to-face contact, and there's no way it can ever replace, you know, our ceremonies and those practices. And we really believe in those ways. Back to the issue of the protocol, you know, those things aren't just things to go through. They're real. You know, they're as real as anything else in terms of how we take care of that place, how we respect that place, how we fulfill our obligations to being who we are, you know, and our life being put in a place. You know, I've been all over the world doing presentations and stuff, and I've never found an Indigenous peoples that have the words human rights in their language, literal translation.
Mm.
We'd say in Yaqui, Omem Tekya, our duty or our obligation to the Creator, which is, you know, fighting when we need to, keeping our ceremonies going, our language, how we treat one another, how we treat the natural world. You know, all of it is encompassed in that. And without those protocols, you know, that were given, we say, you know, the laws, traditions, and customs, the UN Declaration said that, and we use that language to get our Masakova repatriated. There's just two places in the whole UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples that use the word laws. And in our cultural protocols, it's in there. It's Article 11 of the UN Declaration, that we have laws that tell us how we have to treat our sacred items and our sacred places. And if we don't respect those, how are we going to ask anybody else to respect them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are laws here about how we need to be on this place. And everyone in IITC who's from IITC will respect that and want to know so that they can respect this place. Because when we go to their place, you know, they want to tell us, you know, how to respect their protocols.
Going back to how you said, literally nobody has a word for human rights in their language because it wasn't needed. You know, it was already a matter of respect. That's just how you treat other people.
Because we don't talk about rights, we talk about responsibilities. And because we don't separate humans from the rest of the natural world.
So in saying that, it's interesting that there has to be even that word human rights, number one. Number two, that a council had to come together because human rights weren't being recognized.
Yes, that's right. human rights, treaty rights, inherent rights means, you know, when IITC was first sent, you know, by the elders from here, from Ochotisakoan, to go to the United Nations, they say, well, find the other indigenous peoples and get together with them. There was nobody else. It was just us at first. And we did find some words that resonated with our culture, not necessarily human rights, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948, that preamble talks about the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is what it says. And we can understand inherent and inalienable. It means no one can give rights or take it away, not a treaty, not a declaration, not a convention, not a constitution, doesn't give rights, right? Rights are inherent mm-hmm. because of who you are, placed where, you know, on the land, on the place where the Creator put you. And rights, therefore, can't be given or taken away. They can't be given up. They can be upheld or they can be violated. That's all. So, you know, fighting violations of those inherent rights. And in the UN Declaration, in the preamble, we got to define our inherent rights. I'm sure you've read the mm-hmm. UN Declaration. Mm-hmm. You know, it just says, you know, the urgent need to uphold the inherent rights of indigenous peoples. That word comes from something they said when we weren't even there. We weren't there when they... in 1948 when they adopted the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. They say Eleanor Roosevelt wrote those words, the wife of the deceased president, you know. But we could resonate with that idea, you know. So I think, you know, treaty rights uphold inherent rights, and that's how our ancestors tried to ensure that what our inherent rights were would be respected by the colonizer. You know, didn't always turn out that way. But the thing about treaties, like they say in Canada, you know, that treaties don't make nations, but only nations make treaties. And that's international law, too. You know, that it affirmed that nation-to-nation relationship and codified it in a way that was legally binding, or so we thought, you know, on both parties. We're, you know, upholding our treaty mm-hmm. obligations as well. Sometimes giving up land, for example, right. or allowing them to pass through or whatever. But they have not done the same.
That was Andrea Carmen, the Executive Director of the International Indigenous Treaty Council. The IITC represents hundreds of indigenous nations, peoples, and organizations from North, Central, and South America, the Arctic, the Pacific, and the Caribbean. Since the mid-1980s, Andrea has participated in several UN bodies addressing human and cultural rights, environment, climate change, food sovereignty, and repatriation. She served on the steering committee that worked on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and has written about that declaration in several publications. She has conducted over 300 trainings and presentations for Indigenous communities, leaders, organizations, and agencies. She graduated from the University of California with a degree in women's studies and currently lives in Tucson, Arizona. Buffalo's Fire continues to grow while fulfilling our mission to remain an independent news organization that reflects the voice of our Indigenous community. We have never accepted any money from a tribal government because our work has been largely driven by grants. But you can help Buffalo's Fire in reaching its fundraising goal of $10,000 by donating today. Your one-time or recurring donation will help us to continue to bring you the latest headlines to your desktop, mobile device, or tablet every day. Visit our donation page and make your pledge at buffalosfire.com/donate. For Buffalo's Fire and Indigenous Media Freedom Alliance, I'm Alicia Heglin-Thorpe. Thank you for your continued support, and thank you for listening.